The person in whom its invisible agony reaches a certain unendurable level will kill herself the same way a trapped person will eventually jump from the window of a burning high-rise. Make no mistake about people who leap from burning windows. Their terror of falling from a great height is still just as great as it would be for you or me standing speculatively at the same window just checking out the view. That is, the fear of falling remains a constant. The variable here is the other terror, the fire's flames. When the flames get close enough, falling to death becomes the slightly less terrible of two terrors. It's not desiring the fall, it's terror of the flames. And yet nobody down on the sidewalk looking up and yelling, "Don't!" and "Hang on!" can understand the jump. Not really. You'd have to have personally been trapped and felt flames to really understand a terror way beyond falling. So the idea of a person in the grip of it being bound by a suicide contract, some well-meaning substance abuse halfway house makes her sign, is simply absurd. Because such a contract will constrain such a person only until the exact psychic circumstances that made the contract necessary in the first place assert themselves, invisibly and indescribably. That the well-meaning halfway house staff does not understand its overriding terror will only make the depressed resident feel more alone. One fellow psychotically depressed patient Kate Gompert came to know at Newton Wellesley Hospital in Newton 2 years ago was a man in his 50s. He was a civil engineer whose hobby was model trains, like from Lionel Trains, Inc., etc., for which he erected incredibly intricate systems of switching and track that filled his basement recreation room. His wife brought photographs of the trains and networks of trellis and track into the locked ward to help remind him. The man said he had been suffering from psychotic depression for 17 straight years, and Kate Gompert had had no reason to disbelieve him. He was stocky and swart with thinning hair and hands that he held very still in his lap as he sat. 20 years ago, he had slipped on a patch of 3-in-1 brand oil from his model train tracks and bonked his head on the cement floor of his basement rec room in Wellesley Hills, and when he woke up in the ER, he was depressed beyond all human endurance and stayed that way. He'd never once tried suicide, though he confessed that he yearned for unconsciousness without end. His wife was very devoted and loving. She went to Catholic Mass every day. She was very devout. The psychotically depressed man, too, went to daily Mass when he was not institutionalized. He prayed for relief. He still had his job and his hobby. He went to work regularly, taking medical leaves only when the invisible torment got too bad for him to trust himself, or when there was some radical new treatment the psychiatrists wanted him to try. They tried tricyclics, MAOIs, insulin comas, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors,
283,
the new and side-effect-laden quadricyclics. They'd scanned his lobes and effective matrices for lesions and scars. Nothing worked. Not even high amperage ECT relieved it. This happens sometimes. Some cases of depression are beyond human aid. The man's case gave Kate Gompert the howling phantods. The idea of this man going to work and to Mass and building miniaturized railroad networks day after day after day, while feeling anything like what Kate Gompert felt in that ward, was simply beyond her ability to imagine. The rational-spiritual part of her knew this man and his wife must be possessed of a courage way off any sort of known courage chart. But in her toxified soul, Kate Gompert felt only a paralyzing horror at the idea of the squat, dead-eyed man laying toy track slowly and carefully in the silence of his wood-paneled rec room. The silence total, except for the sounds of the track being oiled and snapped together and laid into place, the man's head full of poison and worms, and every cell in his body screaming for relief from flames no one else could help with or even feel. The permanently psychotically depressed man was finally transferred to a place on Long Island to be evaluated for a radical new type of psychosurgery where they supposedly went in and yanked out your whole limbic system, which is the part of the brain that causes all sentiment and feeling. The man's fondest dream was anhedonia, complete psychic numbing, that is, death in life. The prospect of radical psychosurgery was the dangled carrot that Kate guessed still gave the man's life enough meaning for him to hang onto the windowsill by his fingernails, which were probably black and gnarled from the flames. That and his wife. He seemed genuinely to love his wife, and she, him. He went to bed every night at home holding her, weeping for it to be over, while she prayed, or did that devout thing with beads. The couple had gotten Kate Gompert's mother's address and had sent Kate an Xmas card the last 2 years. Mr. and Mrs. Ernest Feaster of Wellesley Hills, Massachusetts, stating that she was in their prayers and wishing her all available joy. Kate Gompert doesn't know whether Mr. Ernest Feaster's limbic system got yanked out or not, whether he achieved anhedonia. The Xmas cards had had excruciating little watercolor pictures of locomotives on them. She could barely stand to think about them, even at the best of times, which the present was not. The 14th of November, year of the Depend Adult Undergarment. Ms. Ruth Van Cleves, first day off new residence, 3-day house restriction. Allowed now to hit meetings outside Enfield if accompanied by some more senior resident the staff judges safe. Ruth Van Cleve and Spike Heels, walking alongside a psychotically depressed Kate Gompert on Prospect just south of Inman Square, Cambridge, a little after 2200 hours, yammering nonstop. Ruth Van Cleve is shaping up to be excruciating for Kate Gompert to be around. Ruth Van Cleve hails from Braintree on the South Shore, is many kilos underweight, wears brass-colored lipstick, and has dry hair teased out in the big hair fashion of decades past. Her face has the late-stage ice addict's concave, long-jawed, insectile look.
284.
Her hair is a dry, tangled cloud with tiny little eyes and bones and projecting beak underneath. Joelle V. Deed said it almost looked like Ruth Van Cleve's hair grew her head instead of the other way around. Kate Gompert's hair is butcher block cut and has recognizable color, at least. Kate Gompert hasn't slept in 4 nights, and her slumped progress up the Prospect sidewalk resembles the lazy tack of a boat in no rush. Ruth Van Cleve talks nonstop into her right ear. It's around 2200 hours on Saturday, and the sodium street lights keep going off and then on again with a stuttered hum, some connection in them loose somewhere. Foot traffic is dense, and the undead and drunks who live in the streets around Inman Square also crowd the sidewalk's edges. And if Kate G looks at the images of passers-by in the darkened shop windows, they become, pedestrians and undead STEM artists, just heads that seem to float across each window unconnected to anything. As in disconnected, floating heads. In doorways by shops are incomplete persons in wheelchairs with creative receptacles where limbs should be, and hand-lettered invitations to help them. An oral narrative begins to emerge. Ms. Ruth V.C. has been remanded to Ennett House by DSS and Family Court after her newborn baby was discovered in a Braintree, Massachusetts alley, swaddled in Walmart advertising circulars whose Harvest Moon value specials had expired 11:01, a Sunday. Ruth Van Cleve had rather unshrewdly left the hospital ID bracelet with its DOB and her own name and health card number on the discarded infant's wrist. The infant is apparently now in a South Shore hospital incubator, attached to machines and tapering off the clonidine.
285.
It received for in utero addictions to substances Kate Gompert can only speculate about.
286.
The father of Ruth Van Cleve's child, she reports, is under the protection and care of the Norfolk County Correctional Authority, awaiting sentencing for what Ruth Van Cleve described several times as operating a pharmaceutical company without a license. What's remarkable to Kate Gompert is that she seems to be able to move forward without any sort of conscious moving forward type volitions. She puts her left foot in front of her right foot, and then her right foot in front of her left foot, and she's moving forward, her whole self, when all she's capable of concentrating on is one foot and then the other foot. Heads glide by in the darkened windows. Some of the Latino males in the vicinity do a kind of sexual checking out as they pass, even though underweight and dry-haired and kind of haggish. Ruth Van Cleve's manner and attire and big hair broadcast that she's all about sexuality and sex. A negative thing about opting for recovery in NA instead of AA is availability and location of meetings. In other words, fewer NA meetings. On a Saturday night, you could stand on the roof of Ennett House in Enfield and be hard-pressed to spit in any direction without hitting some AA venue nearby. Whereas the closest Saturday PM NA meeting is North Cambridge's Clean and Serene group, infamous for crosstalk and chair-throwing, and the thing's beginner's meeting goes from 2,000 to 2,100 hours, and the regular from 2,100 to 2,200 hours. Purposely late, to offset the Saturday night Joneses so many drug addicts suffer weekly, Saturday still being the week's special, mythic, party night, even for persons who long ago ceased to be able to do anything but party 24/7/365. But from Inman Square back to Ennett House is a ghastly hike. Hoof up Prospect to Central Square, and take the Red Line all the way to Park Street Station, and then the maddening Green Line B train forever west on Comm Ave. And it's now after 22:15 hours, meaning Kate Gompert has 75 minutes to get herself and this hideous, despair-producing, slutty, and yammering newcomer beside her back for curfew. Ruth Van Cleve's chatter is as listener-interest-independent as anything Kate Gompert's heard since Randy Lentz got invited to ingest substances and abuse animals elsewhere and left, which was who knows how many days or weeks ago. The two move in and out of cones of epileptic light from fluttering street lamps. Kate Gompert is trying not to shudder as Ruth Van Cleve asks her if she knows some place you can pick up a good toothbrush cheap. Kate Gompert's entire spiritual energy and attention are focused on first her left foot and then her right foot. One of the heads she does not see, floating in the windows with her own unrecognizable head, and Ruth Van Cleve's cloud of hair is the gaunt and spectral hollow-eyed head of poor Tony Krause, who's several steps behind them and matching their slightly serpentine course step for step, eyeing string purses he imagines contain more than just train fare and N.A. newcomers' keychains. The vaporizer chugs and seethes and makes the room's windows weep as Jim Trolch inserts a pro wrestling cartridge in the little TP's viewer and dons his tackiest sport coat and wet combs his hair down smooth so it looks toupee-ish and settles back on his bunk, surrounded by Celdane bottles and 2-ply facial tissue, preparing to call the action. His roommates have long since seen what was coming and screwed. Standing on tiptoe in Subdorm B's curved hallway, using the handle of an inverted tennis racket whose vinyl cover he can absently zip and unzip as he moves the handle around, Michael Pemulis is gently raising one of the panels in the drop ceiling and shifting it on its aluminum strut, the panel, changing its lie on the strut from square-shaped to diamond-shaped, being careful not to let it fall. Lyle hovers cross-legged just a couple millimeters above the top of the towel dispenser in the unlit weight room, eyes rolled up white, lips barely moving, and making no sound. Coach Stitt and Mario tear ass downhill on West Commonwealth on Stitt's old BMW, bound for Evangeline's low-temperature confections in Newton Center, right at the bottom of what usually gets called Heartbreak Hill. Stitt, intense-faced and leaning forward like a skier, his white scarf whipping around and whipping Mario's face in the sidecar, as Mario, too, leans way forward into their downhill flight, preparing to whoop when they bottom out. Ms. Avril Incandenza, seeming somehow to have 3 or 4 cigarettes all going at once, secures from information the phone and email numbers of a journalistic business address on East Tucson, Arizona's Blasted Expanse Boulevard, then begins to dial, using the stern of a blue felt pen to stab at the console's keys.
"Aye!"
cries the man, rushing at the nun, wielding a power tool. The tough-looking nun yells, "Aye!" right back as she kicks him expertly, her habit's skirts whipping complexly around her. The combatants circle each other warily in the abandoned warehouse, both growling. The nun's wimple is askew and soiled. The back of her hand, held out in a bladish martial art fist, displays part of a faded tattoo, some wicked clawed bird of prey. The cartridge opens like this, in violent medias res, then freezes in the middle of the nun's leaping kick, and its title, Blood Sister, One Tough Nun, gets matte dissolved in and bleeds lurid, blood-colored light down into the performance credits rolling across the screen's bottom. Bridget Boone and Francis L. Unwin have come in uninvited and joined Hal in VR6 and are curled up against the arms of the room's other recumbency, their feet touching at the soles. Boone eating unauthorized frozen yogurt from a cylindrical carton. Hal's turned the rheostat down low, and the film's title and credits make their faces glow redly. Bridget Boone extends the confection carton over in Hal's direction in an inviting way, and by way of declining, Hal points to the lump of Kodiak in his cheek and makes a display of leaning out to spit. He appears to be studying the scrolling credits very closely. "So what is this?" Fran Unwin says. Hal looks over at her very slowly. Then even more slowly, raises his right arm and points around the tennis ball he's squeezing at the monitor, where the cartridge's 50-point title is still trickling redly over the credits and frozen scene. Bridget Boone gives him a look.
"What's up your particular butt?"
"I'm isolating. I came in here to be by myself." She has this way that gets to Hal of digging the chocolate yogurt out with a spoon and then inverting the spoon, turning the spoon over so that it always enters her mouth upside down and her tongue gets to contact the confection immediately without the mediation of cold spoon. And for some reason, this has always gotten under Hal's skin.
"So then you should have locked the door."
"Except there aren't locks on the VR doors, as you quite well know."
287.
Round-faced, Franny Unwin says, "Shh." Then, too, sometimes Boone plays with the laden spoon, makes it fly around in front of her face like a child's plane before inverting it and sticking it in.
"Maybe this is partly because this is a public room for everybody that your thinking person probably wouldn't choose to isolate in."
Hal leans over to spit and lets the spit hang for a while before he lets it go. So it hangs there, slowly distending. Boone withdraws the clean spoon just as slowly.
"No matter how sullen and pouty that person is over that person's play, or near lost in full view of a whole crowd that day, I hear."
"Bridget, I forgot to tell you. I saw that Rite Aid's having an enormous clearance on emetics. If I were you, I'd scoot right over."
"You are vile."
Bernadette Longley sticks her long, boxy head in the door and sees Bridget Boone and says,
"I thought I heard you in here,"
and comes in uninvited with Jenny Bash in tow. Hal whimpers. Jenny Bash looks at the large screen. The cartridge's theme music is female choral and very heavy and ironic on the descants. Bernadette Longley looks at Hal.
"You know there's a totally huge lady cruising the halls looking for you, with a notebook and a very determined expression."
Boone banks the spoon back and forth absently.
"He's isolating. He won't respond, and is spitting extra repulsively to get across the point."
Jenny Bash says,
"Haven't you got a huge paper due for Teary tomorrow? There was moaning coming from Struck and Shaw's room."
Hal packs chew down with his tongue.
"Done."
"Figures,"
Bridget Boone says.
"Done, redone, formatted, printed, proofed, collated, stapled."
"Proof to within its life,"
Boone says, barrel rolling the spoon. Hal can tell she's done a couple one-hitters. He's looking straight at the wall screen, squeezing the ball so hard his forearm keeps swelling to twice its size.
"Plus, I hear your best friend in the whole world did something really funny today,"
Longley says.
"She means Pemulous," Fran Unwin tells Hal.
Bridget Boone makes dive bomber sounds and swoops the spoon around.
Sounds like too good a story not to save, and let my craving for it build and build until finally it's like I have to hear it or die right on the spot.
What is up his butt? Jenny Bash asks Fran Unwin.
Fran Unwin's a sort of Hanuman-faced girl, with a torso and trunk about twice as long as her legs, and a scuttly, vaguely simian style of play. Bernadette Longley wears knee-length candy cane trousers and a sweatshirt with the fleecy inside out. All the girls are now in socks. Hal notes that girls always seem to slip out of their shoes when they assume any kind of spectatorial posture. 8 empty, white sneakers now sit mute and weird at various points, slightly sunk in carpet pile. No two of the shoes face quite the same exact direction. Male players, on the other hand, tend to leave the footwear on when they come in and sit down somewhere. Girls literally embody the idea of making yourself at home. Males, when they come in somewhere and sit down, project an air of transience. Remain suited up and mobile. It's the same whenever Hal comes in and sits down someplace where people are already gathered. He's aware that they sense he's somehow there only in a very technical sense, that he's got an air of moment's notice readiness to leave about him. Boone extends her carton of TCBY toward Longley in an inviting way, even tilting it invitingly back and forth.
288.
Longley puffs her cheeks and blows air out with a fatigued sound. At least three different smells of cologne and skin cream struggle for primacy in here. Bridget Boone's free L.A. Gear shoes are both on their sides from the force of having been almost kicked off her feet. Hal's spit makes a sound against the bottom of the wastebasket. Jenny Bash has bigger arms than Hal. The viewing room is redly dim. Bash asks Unwin what they're watching. Blood Sister, One Tough Nun, one of himself's few commercial successes, wouldn't have made near the money it made if it hadn't come out just as Interlace was starting to purchase first-run features for its rental menus and hyping the cartridges with one-time, spontaneous disseminations. It was the sort of sleazy-looking shock-sploitation film that would have had a two-week run in multiplex theaters 8 and above and then gone right to the featureless brown boxes of magnetic video limbo. Hal's critical take on the film is that himself, at certain dark points, when abstract theory issues seem to provide an escape from the far more wrenching creative work of making humanly true or entertaining cartridges, had made films in certain commercial-type genre modes that so grotesquely exaggerated the formulaic shticks of the genres that they became ironic meta-cinematic parodies on the genres. Sub-slash-inversions of the genres, cognoscenti taken in, we're wont to call them. The meta-cinematic parody idea itself was aloof and over-clever to Hal's way of thinking, and he's not comfortable with the way himself always seemed to get seduced by the very commercial formulae he was trying to invert, especially the seductive formulae of violent payback, that is, the cathartic bloodbath, that is, the hero trying with every will fiber to eschew the generic world of the stick and fist, and but driven by unjust circumstance back to the violence again, to the cathartic final bloodbath the audience is brought to applaud instead of mourn. Himself's best in this vein was The Night Wears a Sombrero, a Lang-esque meta-western but also a really good western, with chintzy homemade interior sets but breathtaking exteriors shot outside Tucson, Arizona. An ambivalent but finally avenging sun story played out against dust-colored skies and big angles of flesh-colored mountain, plus with minimal splatter, shot men clutching their chests and falling deliciously sideways, all hats staying on at all times. Blood Sister, One Tough Nun, was a supposedly ironic lampoon of the avenging cleric splatter films of the late BS-90s. Nor did himself make any friends on either side of the concavity trying to shoot the thing in Canada. Hal tries to imagine the tall, slumped, tremulous stork shape of himself, inclined at an osteoporotic angle over digital editing equipment for hours on end, deleting and inserting code, arranging Blood Sister One Tough Nun into subversive slash inversion, and can't summon one shadowy idea of what himself might have been feeling as he patiently labored. Maybe that was the point of the thing's meta-silliness, to have nothing really felt going on.
289.
Jenny Bash has left VR6's door agape, and Idris, Arslanian, and Todd Postal Waite Postlethwaite, and Kent Blott all drift in and sit Indian-style in a loose hemisphere on the thick carpet between the girls' recumbency and Hal's recumbency, and are more or less considerately quiet. They all keep their sneakers on. Postal Waite's nose is a massive, proboscoid, bandaged thing. Kent Blott wears a sports fisherman's cap with an extremely long bill. That queer, faint smell of hot dogs that seems to follow Idris Arslanian around begins to insinuate itself into the room's colognes. He isn't wearing the rayon handkerchief as a blindfold, but does have it tied around his neck. No one asks him about it. While the littler kids are consummate spectators and are sucked immediately into Blood Sister's unfolding narrative, and the older females seem to take some kind of psychic cue from the little boys and subside too and watch, until after a while, Hal's the only person in the room who isn't 100% absorbed. The entertainment's uptake is that a tough biker chick-type girl from the mean streets of Toronto is found OD'd, beaten up, molested, and robbed of her leather jacket outside the portcullis of a downtown convent, and is rescued, nursed, befriended, spiritually guided and converted, saved, is the weak entendre made much of in the first act's dialogue, by a tough-looking older nun who, it turns out, she reveals, the tough older nun, had herself been hauled up out of a life of Harleys, narcotics dealing and addiction, by an even tougher, even older nun, a nun who had herself been saved by a tough ex-biker nun, and so on. The last saved biker chick becomes a tough and street-smart nun in the same urban order, and is known on the mean streets as Blood Sister. And Wimple or not, still rides her hog from parish to parish, and still knows Aikido, and is not to be fucked with, is the word on the streets. The motivational crux here being that almost this whole order of nuns is staffed by nuns who'd been saved from Toronto's mean, dead-end streets by other, older, tougher, saved nuns. So, endless novenas later, Blood Sister eventually feels this transitive spiritual urge to go out and find a troubled adolescent female of her own to save and bring into the order, thereby discharging her soul's debt to the old tough nun who'd saved her. Through processes obscure, a Toronto troubled but savable adolescent girl directory of some sort, Bridget Boone cuts wise, Blood Sister eventually takes on a burn-scarred, deeply troubled adolescent punker-type Toronto girl who is sullen and, yes, reasonably tough, but is also vulnerable and emotionally tormented. The girl's pink, shiny, burn-scarred face tends to writhe in misery whenever she thinks Blood Sister's not looking, by the terrible depredation she's endured as a result of her rapacious and unshakable addiction to crank cocaine, the kind you have to convert and cook up yourself, and with ether, which is highly combustible, and which people used before somebody found out baking soda and temperature flux would do the same thing, which dates the film's BS time period even more clearly than the tough, tortured punk girl's violet, stelliform coiffure.
290.
But so, Blood Sister eventually gets the girl clean by nurturing her through withdrawal in a locked sacristy, and the girl becomes less sullen by degrees that almost have audible clicks to them. The girl stops trying to dicky the lock of the sacramental wine cabinet, stops farting on purpose during matins and vespers, stops going up to the Trappists who hang around the convent and asking them for the time, and other sly little things to try to make them slip up and speak aloud, etc. A couple times the girl's face writhes in emotional torment and vulnerability even when Blood Sister's looking. The girl gets a severe and somewhat lesbianic haircut, and her roots establish themselves as softly brown. Blood Sister, revealing biceps like nobody's business, beats the girl at arm wrestling. They both laugh. They compare tattoos.
This marks the start of a brutally drawn-out getting-to-know-and-trust-you montage. A genre convention, this montage involving Harley rides at such speeds that the girl has to keep her hand on Blood Sister's head to keep B.S.'s Wimple from flying off, and long conversational walks, filmed at wide angle, and protracted and basically unwinnable games of charades with the Trappists, plus some quick scenes of Blood Sister finding the girl's Marlboros and dildo facsimile lighter in the wastebasket, of the girl doing chores unsullenly under B.S.'s grudgingly approving eye, of candlelit scripture study sessions with the girl's finger under each word she reads, of the girl carefully snipping the last bits of split violet ends from her soft brown hair, of the more senior tough nuns punching Blood Sister's shoulder approvingly as the girl's eyes start to get that impending conversion gleam in them. Then, finally, of Blood Sister and the girl habit shopping, the girl's burned lantern jaw and hairless Promethean brow frozen in a sunlit montage climax shot under a novitiate Wimple's gull wings, all accompanied by, no kidding, getting to know you, which Hal imagines the stork justified to himself as subversively saccharine. This all takes about half an hour. Bridget Boone of the Indianapolis Archdiocese begins to declaim briefly on Blood Sister One Tough Nun's ironic anti-Catholic subthesis, that the deformed addicted girl's salvation here seemed simply the exchange of one will-obliterating habit for another, substituting one sort of outlandish head decoration for another, and gets pinched by Jenny Bash and shushed by just about everyone in the room but Hal, who could pass for asleep except for the brief lists to port over the wastebasket to spit, and in fact is experiencing some of the radical loss of concentration that attends THC withdrawal, and is thinking about another, even more familiar J.O. Incandenza cartridge, even while he watches this one with the other ETAs. This other attention object is the late himself's so-called inversion of the corporate politics genre, low-temperature civics. An executive suite soap opera filled with power plays, position jockeyings, timid adulteries, martinis, and malignantly pretty female executives in elegant, tight-fitting dress-for-success wear who eat their paunched and muddled male counterparts for political lunch. Hal knows that low-temperature civics wasn't an inversion or lampoon at all, but derived right from the dark B.S. 80s period when himself had changed careers from government service to private entrepreneurism, when a sudden infusion of patent receipts left him feeling post-carrot anhedonic and existentially unmoored, and himself took an entire year off to drink wild turkey and watch broadcast television tycoon operas like Lorimar's Dynasty and others in a remote spa off Canada's northwest coast, where he supposedly met and bonded with Lyle, now of the ETA weight room. What's intriguing, but unknown to everyone in VR6, is the way Boone's take on himself's take of the substitution of one crutch for another interpretation of substituting Catholic devotion for chemical dependence is very close to the way many, not yet desperate enough newcomers to Boston AA, see Boston AA as just an exchange of slavish dependence on the bottle slash pipe for slavish dependence on meetings and banal shibboleths and robotic piety, an attitude of platitude, and use this idea that it's still slavish dependence as an excuse to stop trying Boston AA and to go back to the original slavish substance dependence, until that dependence has finally beaten them into such a double-bound desperation that they finally come back in with their faces hanging off their skulls and beg to be told just what platitudes to shout and how high to adjust their vacant grins. Some substance-dependent persons, though, have already been so broken by the time they first come in that they don't care about stuff like substitution or banality. They'll give their left nut to trade their original dependence in for robotic platitudes and pep rally cheer. They're the ones with the gun to their head, the ones who stick and hang. It remains to be determined whether Joelle Van Dyne, whose first appearance in a James O. Incandenza project occurred in this very low-temperature civics, Is one of these people who've come into AA/NA shattered enough to stick? But she's starting to ID more and more with the commitment speakers she hears, who did come in shattered enough to know it's get straight or die. A click and a half straight downhill from ETA, Joelle is hitting the reality is for people that can't handle drugs group, a meeting of the NA splinter Cocaine Anonymous.
291.
Mostly because the meeting's in the St. Elizabeth's Hospital Grand Rounds Auditorium, just a couple floors down from where Don Gately, whom she just got done visiting and mopping the massive unconscious forehead of, is lying in the trauma wing in a truly bad way. Cocaine Anonymous meetings have a long preamble and endless little Xeroxed formalities they read aloud at the start, is one reason Joelle avoids CA. But the opening stuff is done by the time she gets down and comes in and gets some burnt, urn-bottom coffee and finds an available seat. The only empty seats are in the meeting's back row. Denial aisle, the back rows are usually called. And Joelle is surrounded by cachexic newcomers crossing and uncrossing their legs every few seconds and sniffing compulsively and looking like they're wearing everything they own. Plus, there's the row of standing men. There's a certain hard-faced type of male in Boston fellowships who refuses ever to sit for meetings. Standing behind the back row, legs set wide and arms crossed, and talking to each other out of the sides of their mouths. And she can tell the standing men are looking at her bare knees over her shoulder, making little comments about the knees and the veil. She thinks, with fearful sentiment of Don Gately.
292.
A tube down his throat, torn by fever and guilt and shoulder pain, offered Demerol by well-meaning but clueless MDs, in and out of delirium, torn, convinced that certain men with hats wished him ill, looking at his room's semi-private ceiling like it would eat him if he dropped his guard. The big blackboard up on the stage says, "The reality is for people that can't handle drugs group welcomes tonight's commitment speakers, the freeway access group from Mattapan," which is deep in the colored part of Boston where Cocaine Anonymous tends to be most heavily concentrated. The speaker just starting in at the podium when Joelle sits down is a tall, yellowish-colored man with a weightlifter's build and frightening eyes, slow and a kind of tannin brown. He's been in CA 7 months, he says. He eschews the normal CA drug-a-log's macho war stories and gets right to his bottom, his jumping-off place. Joelle can tell he's trying to tell the truth, and not just posturing and performing the way so many CAs seem like they do. His story's full of colored idioms and those annoying little colored hand motions and gestures, but to Joelle it doesn't seem like she cares that much anymore. She can identify. The truth has a kind of irresistible unconscious attraction at meetings, no matter what the color or fellowship. Even denial aisle, and the standing men are absorbed by the colored man's story. The colored man says his thing is he'd had a wife and a little baby daughter at home in Mattapan's Perry Hill projects, and another baby on the way. He'd managed to hang on to his menial riveter's assistant job at Universal Bleacher right up the street from here in Enfield because his addiction to crank cocaine wasn't every day. He smoked on your binge-type basis, mostly weekends. Hellacious, psychopathic, bank account emptying binges, though. Like getting strapped to a Raytheon missile, and you don't stop till that missile stops, Jim. He says his wife had got temp work cleaning houses, but when she worked, they had to put their little girl in a daycare that just about ate her day's pay. So his paycheck was like their total float. And his weekend binges with a glass pipe caused them no end of financial insecurity, which he mispronounces. Which brings him to his last binge, the bottom, which predictably occurred on a payday. This check just had to go for groceries and rent. They were 2 months back, and there was not jack shit in the house in the way of to eat. At a smoke break at Universal Bleacher, he'd made sure and bought just one single vial, for just a tensky, for a Sunday night treat after a weekend of abstinence and groceries and quality time with his pregnant wife and little daughter. The wife and little daughter were to meet him after work right off the bus stop at Brighton Best Savings, right under the big clock, to help him deposit the paycheck right then and there. He'd let his wife stipulate the meeting at the bank because he knew, in a self-disgusted way even then, that there was this hazard of paycheck-type incidents from binges he'd pulled in the past, and their financial insecurity was now whatever words passed the word deep shit. And he knew goddamn well he could not afford to fuck up this time. He says that's how he used to think of it to himself. Fucking up. He didn't even make it to the bus after clocking out, he said. Two other Holmeses, in Riveting, had 3 vials each.
293.
Which vials they had, like, brandished at him. And he'd kicked in his 1 vial because 2 1/3 vials versus 1 thin-ass Sunday night vial was only a fucking fool way out of touch with the whole seize the opportunity concept could pass that shit up. In short, it was the familiar insanity of money in the pocket and no defense against the urge, and the thought of his woman holding his little girl in her little knit cap and mittens standing under the big clock in cold March dusk didn't so much get pushed aside as somehow shrink to a tiny locket-size picture in the center of a part of him he and the Holmeses had set out busily to kill with the pipe. He says he never made the bus. They passed a bottle of rye around the old Ford Mystique, one of the Holmeses profiled, and fired up right in the car. And after he once fired up with dollars in his pocket, the fat woman with the little helmet with horns on it done already like fucking sang, Jim.
294.
The man's hands grip the sides of the podium, and he rests his weight on his elbow-locked arms in a way that conveys both abjection and pluck. He invites the CAs to let's just draw the curtain of charity over the rest of the night scene, which after the check-cashing stop got hazy with missile exhaust anyhow. But so he finally did get home to Mattapan the next morning, Saturday morning, sick and green-yellow, and on that mean post-crank slide, dying for more and willing to kill for more, and yet so mortified and ashamed of having done fucked up again, that just going up the elevator to their apartment was maybe the bravest thing he'd ever done up to that point, he felt. It was like 0600 in the AM, and they weren't there. There was nobody home, and in the sort of way where the place's emptiness pulsed and breathed. An envelope was slid under the door from the BHA.
295.
Not the salmon color of an eviction notice, but a green last warning with regards to rent. And he went into the kitchen and opened up the fridge, hating himself for hoping there was a beer. In the fridge was a jar of grape jelly, near empty, and a half a can of biscuit mix. And that, plus a sour empty fridge odor, was all Jim. A little plastic jar of labelless food bank peanut butter so empty its insides had knife scrapes on the sides, and a little clotted box of salt was all there was in the whole rest of the kitchen. But what sent his face clear down off his skull and broke him in two, though, was he said when he saw the Pam shiny empty biscuit pan on top of the stove and the plastic rind of the peanut butter's safety seal wrap on top of the wastebasket's tall pile. The little locket picture in the back of his head swelled and became a sharp, focused scene of his wife and little girl and little unborn child eating what he now could see they must have eaten last night and this morning, while he was out ingesting their groceries and rent. This was his cliff edge, his personal intersection of choice. Standing there, loose-faced in the kitchen, running his finger around a shiny pan, with not one little crumb of biscuit left in it. He sat down on the kitchen tile with his scary eyes shut tight but still seeing his little girl's face. They'd ate some charity peanut butter on biscuits, washed down with tap water, and a grimace. Their apartment was 6 floors up in Perry Hills building number 5. The window didn't open but could be broke through with a running start. He didn't kill himself, though, he says. He just got up and walked out. He didn't leave his wife a note.
Not nothing. He went and walked the whole 4 clicks to Shattuck Shelter and Jamaica Plain. He felt like for sure they'd have been better off without him, he said. But he said he didn't know why, but he didn't kill himself. But he didn't. He figures there was some God involvement sitting there on the floor. He just decided to go to Shattuck and surrender and get straight and never, ever have his little girl's grimacing face in his hungover head ever again, James. And Shattuck Shelter, by coincidence, that usually had a waiting list every March until it got warm, they'd just kicked out some sorry-ass specimen for defecating in the shower. And they took him, the speaker. He asked for a CA meeting right away, and a Shattuck staff guy called somebody Afro-American with a lot of clean recovered time, and the speaker got taken to his first CA meeting. That was 224 days ago, tonight. That night, when the colored CA crocodile dropped him off back at the Shattuck, after he'd wept in front of other colored men at his first meeting and told men he didn't know from shit about the big clock and glass pipe and paycheck and the biscuits in his little girl's face, and after he come back to the Shattuck and got buzzed through and the buzzer sounded for supper, it turned out, by coincidence, that the Saturday night Shattuck supper was coffee and peanut butter sandwiches. It was the end of the week and the shelter's donated food had run out. They only had PB on cheap-ass white bread and Sunny Square instant coffee, the cheap shit that doesn't even quite dissolve all the way. He's got your autodidactic orator's way with emotional dramatic pauses that don't seem affected. Joelle makes another line down the styrofoam coffee cup with her fingernail and chooses consciously to believe it isn't affected, the story's emotive drama. Her eyes feel sandy from forgetting to blink. This always happens when you don't expect it, when it's a meeting you have to drag yourself to and are all but sure will suck. The speaker's face has lost its color, shape, everything distinctive. Something has taken the tight ratchet in Joelle's belly and turned it 3 turns to the good. It's the first time she's felt sure she wants to keep straight no matter what it means facing. No matter if Don Gately takes Demerol, or goes to jail, or rejects her if she can't show him the face. It's the first time in a long time, tonight, 11:14, Joelle's even considered possibly showing somebody the face. After the pause, the speaker says all the other sorry motherfuckers in the Shattuck shelter in there started into bitching about what was this shit, peanut butter sandwiches for fucking supper. The speaker says how whatever he silently thanked for, just that particular sandwich he held and chewed, washing it down with gritty Sunny Square coffee, that thing became his higher power. He's now 7+ months clean. Universal Bleacher let him go, but he's got steady work at Logan, pushing a 3rd shift mop, and a Holmes on his cruise also in the program, by coincidence. His pregnant wife, it turned out, had gone to an unwed mother's shelter with Chantel that night. She was still in there. DSS still won't let him appeal his wife's restraining order and see Chantel. But he got to talk to his little girl on the phone just last month. And he's now straight, from giving up and joining the freeway access group and getting active and taking the voluntary suggestions of the Fellowship of Cocaine Anonymous. His wife was due to have her baby around Xmas. He said he didn't know what was going to happen to him or his family. But he says he has received certain promises from his new family, the Freeway Access Group of Cocaine Anonymous. And so he had certain hope-type emotions about the future inside. He didn't so much conclude or make obligatory reference to gratitude or any of that usual shit as grip the lectern and shrug and say he'd started feeling just last month that the choice he made on the kitchen floor was the right choice, personally speaking. Entertainment-wise, things take a rapid turn for the splattery once the tough girl Blood Sisters seem to have saved is found bluely dead in her novitiate's cot,
her habit's interior pockets stuffed with all kinds of substances and paraphernalia, and her arm a veritable forest of syringes. Tight shot of B.S., face working purply, staring down at the XX punker. Suspecting foul play instead of spiritual recidivism, blood sister. Disregarding first the other cheek pieties, and then the impassioned pleas, and then the direct orders of the vice mother superior. Who happens now to be the tough nun who'd saved blood sister way back? Begins reverting to her former Toronto mean street pre-salvation, tough biker chick ways. Demufflering her Harley hog. Hauling an age-faded, stud-covered leather bike jacket out of storage and squeezing it over her pectoral swollen habit. Unbandaging her most lurid tattoos, shaking down former altar boys for information, flipping off motorists who get in her bike's way. Meeting old street contacts in dim saloons and tossing back jiggers with even the most serotic of them. Beating, bludgeoning, akitoing, disarming thugs of power tools, avenging the desalvation and demapping of her young charge. Determined to prove that the girl's death was no accident or backslide. That blood sister had not failed with the soul she'd chosen to save, to discharge her own soul's debt to the tough old vice mother superior who'd saved her, blood sister, so far back. Several thuggish stuntmen and countless liters of potassium thiocyanate later.
296.
The truth does out. The novitiate girl had been murdered by the Mother Superior, the Order's top and toughest nun. This Mother Superior is the nun who'd saved the vice Mother Superior, who'd saved Blood Sister, meaning, ironically, that the evidence Blood Sister needs to prove that her salvation debt really was discharged is also evidence inimical to the legal interests of the tough nun to whom Blood Sister's own savior is obligated. So Blood Sister gets increasingly tortured and ill-tempered as evidence of the Mother Superior's guilt accretes. In one scene, she says, "Fuck." In another, she swings a censer like a mace and brains an old verger who's one of the Mother Superior's stooges, knocking his toothless head clean off. Then in Act 3, a veritable orgy of retribution follows the full emergence of the sordid truth. It seems that the tough old vice mother superior, namely the nun who'd saved blood sister, had in fact not been saved, truly, after all. Had in fact, during 20-plus years of exemplary novena-saying and wafer-baking, been suffering a kind of hidden degenerative recidivist soul rot, and had resumed the vice MS at about the time Blood Sister had donned the habit of full nunhood, had not only resumed substance dependence, but had started actually dealing in serious weights of whatever at the time was most profitable, which after 20-plus years had changed from Marseillaise heroin to Colombian freebaseable-grade Bing Crosby, to support her own hidden habit, covertly operating a high-volume retail operation out of the Order's Community Outreach Rescue Mission's little-used confessionals. This nun superior, the top-tough mother superior nun, stumbling onto the drug operation after the now-demapped verger informed her that a suspicious number of limousines were discharging gold-chained and not very penitent-looking persons into the Order's Community Outreach Rescue Mission, and disastrously unable to summon the pious humility to accept the fact that she'd failed, it seemed, at truly and forever saving the ex-dealer, whose salvation the Mother Superior required to discharge the debt to the now-retired octogenarian nun who'd saved her. This Mother Superior herself is the one who murdered Blood Sister's ex-punk novitiate to silence the girl. What emerges is that Blood Sister's addicted punk girl substance-copping venue, when she was out there pre-salvation, had been nothing other than the Vice Mother Superior's infamous Community Outreach Rescue Mission. In other words, the nun who'd saved Blood Sister, but had herself been secretly unsaved, had been the tough girl's Bing dealer. Is why the tough non-Catholic girl'd been so mysteriously adept at the confidier. The Order's Mother Superior had figured that
It was only a matter of time before the girl's conversion and salvation reached the sort of spiritual pitch where her guarded silence broke, and she told Blood Sister the seamy truth about the nun she, Blood Sister, thought had saved her, Blood Sister. So she, the Mother Superior, had eliminated the girl's map, ostensibly. She, the Mother Superior, told her lieutenant, the Vice Mother Superior, to save her, the Vice Mother Superior, from exposure and excommunication, and maybe worse if the girl weren't silenced.
297.
This narratively prolix and tangled stuff all gets explicated at near kabuki volume during an appalling free-for-all in the office of the Mother Superior, who hadn't saved the Vice MS, who'd saved Blood Sister, with the two senior nuns, who'd been tough and unsaved back in the Ontarian days when men were men and so were drug-addicted bike chicks, teaming up and kicking Blood Sister's ass, the fight scene a blur of swirling habitments and serious martial arts against the spot-lit backdrop of the wall's huge decorative mahogany crucifix, with Blood Sister giving a good account of herself but still getting her wimple beat in, and finally, after several whirling kicks to the forehead, starting to bid adieu to her corporeal map and commend herself to the arms of God, until the unsaved recidivist Vice Mother Superior nun who'd saved Blood Sister, wiping blood from her eyes after a headbutt and seeing the Mother Superior about to decapitate Blood Sister with a souvenir Champlain-era tomahawk the Huron nun who'd been saved by the original founder of the Toronto Tough Girl Saving Order had used to decapitate Jesuit missionaries before she, the tough Huron nun, had been saved, seeing the tomahawk raised with both arms before the normally pious-eyed old Mother Superior's face, a face now rendered indescribable in aspect by the absence of humility and the passion for truth silencing that added up to pure and radical evil, seeing now the upraised hatchet and demonized face of the MS, the unsaved Vice Nun has a moment of epiphanic, anti-recidivist spiritual clarity and averts Blood Sister's demapping by leaping across the office and cold-cocking the Mother Superior with a large, decorative, mahogany, Christian object, so symbolically obvious it needn't even be named. The object's symbolic unsubtlety making both Hal and Bridget Boone cringe. Now Blood Sister has the Champlain-era hatchet, and the unsaved nun who'd saved her has an unnamed object whose mahogany's no match for a hatchet, and they stand facing each other over the prone Mother Superior's puddle of skirts, chests heaving, and the Vice MS has a writhing expression under her askew wimple like, "Go ahead, make the circle of recidivist retribution against the nun you thought had saved you, but ultimately couldn't even save herself. Complete the lapsarian circuit." Or whatever. They stare at each other for countless frames, the office wall behind them cruciformly pale, where the unnamed object had hung. Then Blood Sister shrugs in resignation and drops the tomahawk, and turns and with an ironic little obeisance walks out the Mother Superior's office door and through the little sacristy and over the altar and down the little convent nave, bike boots echoing on the tile, emphasizing the silence, and out the big doors whose tympanum overhead is carved with a sword and a plowshare and a syringe and a soup ladle and the motto, "Contraria sunt complementa," the heaviness of which makes Hal cringe so severely it's Boone who has to supply the translation Kent Blott asks for.
298.
On screen, we're still following the tough nun, or ex-nun. The fact that the hatchet she resignedly dropped fetched the prone Mother Superior a pretty healthy knock is presented as clearly accidental, because she, Blood Sister, is still walking away from the convent, moving emphatically and in a gradually deepening focus, limping toughly eastward into the twittering Toronto dawn. The cartridge's closing sequence shows her astride her hog on Toronto's meanest street, about to lapse, backslide back into her tough, pre-saved ways? It's unclear, in a way that's supposed to be rich. Her expression is agnostic at best, but the huge sign of a discount Harley muffler outlet juts just at the horizon she's roaring toward. The closing credits are the odd lime green of bugs on a windshield. It's hard to tell whether Boone and Bash's applause is sarcastic. There's that post-entertainment flurry of changed positions and stretched limbs and critical sallies. Out of nowhere, Hal remembers Smothergill. Postlethwaite says he and the